Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good day, Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the June 18th reading of The Environment. My name is John. Today, we'll plan to share the following main articles from the magazine of the Sierra Club. The largest U.S. offshore wind project is ready to go, despite Trump's vendetta. From the magazine of the Sierra Club, Louisiana residents score major legal win for clean air and climate. And from the magazine of the Nature Conservancy, we'll share Life at the Water's Edge. A frequently flooded neighborhood on the outskirts of Baltimore is fighting to envision a climate-resilient future. On to our first article from the magazine of the Sierra Club. The largest U.S. offshore wind project is ready to go, despite Trump's vendetta. But his tariff war could add hundreds of millions to the price tag. Written by Laura Stewart. It opens up with a photograph, a picture of a crane out at sea building what looks to be a wind tower, of course, and a ship up next to it with the crane on it, and includes a broad, expansive sea with either a sunrise or a sunset. The story continues. The largest offshore wind project in the United States is set to be completed on time, a win for an industry that has faced uncertainty under the Trump administration. Construction of Dominion Energy's 176-turbine project off the coast of Virginia Beach is nearly 60% complete, according to the company. When completed, the project is expected to generate enough energy to power roughly 660,000 homes, or 25% of Dominion's residential customers in Virginia. In January, President Trump signed an executive order that halted new leases for offshore wind in federal waters and directed federal agencies to pause permitting for onshore and offshore wind projects. The administration went further to stop one project, Empire Wind, a massive wind farm off the coast of Long Island, with a stop work order in April that sparked concern in the wind industry. The order was lifted on May 19th after New York Governor Kathy Hochul spent weeks negotiating with the administration, allowing the $5 billion project to continue. Dominion's largest project in Virginia, Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind, or CVOW, is still moving ahead. The facility is on schedule for its target completion date at the end of 2026, said John Larson, Director of Public Policy and Economic Development at Dominion Energy. Some wind turbines will be installed later this summer and will begin delivering power later this year. 2 6-megawatt pilot turbines have been delivering power since October 2020. Eileen Wohl, former Offshore Energy Program Director for the Sierra Club Virginia Chapter, which has been involved in moving the project forward since 2013, said the path is clear for Dominion to complete it. When it comes to the political challenges, there's only so much we can do about Trump and his pause, Wohl said. But she is hopeful that there won't be any roadblocks for developing CVOW. There's just too much of a support system, she said. While construction has not stopped, the Trump administration's tariffs on the steel industry may drive up the project's cost. Jeremy Slayton, a spokesperson for Dominion, said the tariffs would add an additional $120 million through the end of the second quarter. If the tariffs stay in effect through the end of the project, they would add an additional $500 million to the cost. For Dominion's customers, that would mean an additional 4 cents per month on their utility bills, Slayton said. At this point, there's a photo inserted, very, very calm sea, cloudy skies, and again, the crane from a large green ship, putting up some steel girders on what looks like a wind turbine. Story continues. Larson said that offshore wind saves customers and the state money in the long run. Unlike fuel, the cost of offshore wind is not impacted by severe weather events. For example, in December 2023, a storm in Virginia caused rolling blackouts in surrounding states and drove up demand for natural gas. On Christmas Eve that same year, the price of fuel skyrocketed. If the CBOW project had been completed, Larson said, it would have saved over $10 million in fuel costs in a single day. The CVOW project has garnered bipartisan support in Virginia, which committed to 100% renewable energy by 2050 with the passage of the Clean Economy Act in 2020. The act requires Dominion Energy and Appalachian Power, the largest utilities in the state, to deliver electricity from 100% renewable resources by 2045 and 2050, respectively. Virginia is a regulated utility state, which means major utilities such as Dominion Energy operate as monopolies within their designated service areas. The Virginia State Corporation Commission oversees and approves their rates and services to ensure that consumers receive services at just and reasonable rates. Even Virginia's Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin recognizes the value and opportunity of offshore wind in the state. He has advanced efforts to strengthen the offshore wind industry, supporting initiatives like the CVOW project and the LS Greenlink wind supply chain manufacturing facility. Supporters of CVOW say it will bring economic benefits to the region by creating new jobs in construction, manufacturing, and maintenance. This summer, there will be 1,500 people working on the project, Larson said. On average, 900 people will be employed per year over the life of the project. Dominion has been working with local communities, including K-12 schools, community colleges, and higher education institutions to recruit personnel. The CVOW project has received some pushback from community members concerned about their ocean view and fossil fuel companies, said Grayson Holmes, senior attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center. Community pushback has been relatively minimal, he added. Last year, a coalition of conservatives sued the Biden administration seeking to halt construction of CVOW. The groups, including the Koch-funded Heartland Institute, claimed that federal agencies did not adequately address the ecological impacts of the project and ignored threats to endangered North Atlantic right whales when they approved the project. Southern Environmental Law Center continues to be hopeful that the federal government will defend the permits. Southern Environmental Law Center worked with Dominion to ensure that land and marine animal protections were put in place, Holmes said. Construction of the project can only take place from May to October, when endangered whales are least likely to be in the area. Dominion has trained observers on their boats who track the whales, he said. They can't completely eliminate the impacts, but they're doing what they can. In Virginia, the demand for energy has skyrocketed as data centers continue to expand in the state. Virginia is the largest data center market in the world. About 70% of the world's internet traffic runs through Northern Virginia's Data Center Alley, according to the Virginia Economic Development Partnership. Offshore wind could help offset this demand, Holmes said. Wind is not the only solution, but it is an important part of the overall spectrum, he said. It feels like it should be a win-win for everyone. Our next article, also from the magazine of the Sierra Club, Louisiana residents score major legal win for clean air and the climate. Residents cross their fingers after judge orders Chevron to pay a local community for pollution caused by oil and gas. Written by Delaney Nolan. Article opens up with a photograph of a very small island, maybe 20 feet square, shrub covered, and a single individual on it looking to be fishing in some murky, wavy water. It's captioned, P.J. Hahn, an environmental consultant and former Plaquemines Parish Coastal Zone Manager in Louisiana, on a small patch of land with mangroves. All that remains after the land around it eroded away. And this story continues. In Delacroix, Louisiana, it's easy to see how the land disappears. Houses here are scattered across thin streaks of land, while in every direction the marsh's brackish water encroaches onto what was once solid earth. across Plaquemines Parish, where Delacroix is located, areas that maps show as green land are in fact submerged. Over the last 90-odd years, Louisiana has lost land area the size of Delaware. Experts have tied the increased rate of land loss to the same oil and gas industries that have made this region ground zero for liquefied natural gas exports. As a result of the dredging, erosion, saltwater intrusion, and warming seas caused by burning fossil fuels, Plaquemines Parish and the rest of coastal Louisiana loses a football field worth of land every 48 minutes on average. In 2013, six Louisiana parishes and state offices began filing dozens of cases against 98 oil and gas companies that operated around the coast, alleging that their activities were a major contributor to this land loss. The first of these multi-year lawsuits came to a head in April in Plaquemines Parish when a jury in Pointe a la Hache ordered Chevron to pay the parish $744 million. The case, which focused on an area known as Bayou Gentilly oil field next to Delacroix, found that oil companies were responsible for erosion and land loss caused largely by the canals they dredged through the marsh. Since oil companies began working in Bayou Gentilly, the marsh has shrunk from 21,000 acres to just 8,000 acres. When the Pointe a la Hache jury read out guilty, it set a striking precedent for other communities across this fragile coastline and the fight for accountability at large. The lawsuit is only the first of 42 ongoing suits filed by local governments across coastal Louisiana against major oil and gas companies. Together, the lawsuits, known as legacy lawsuits, are seeking billions of dollars due to land loss and pollution. The case's attorney, John Carmouche, who is arguing many of the lawsuits, asserted that Chevron was in violation of a 1978 law requiring companies to clean and restore oil exploration sites to their original condition. Chevron's lawyers countered that the law does not apply to anything they did before 1978, and some of the damage goes back as far as 1941. The original activity was carried out by Texaco, which Chevron bought in 2001. The jury, made up by Plaquemines residents who've watched the land around them erode, sided with Carmouche. They awarded about $9 million for abandoned equipment and $161 million for contamination, but $575 million is specifically for land loss. Looked at another way, the jury decided each acre of lost land was worth about $44,000. Now, locals are hopeful that this settlement money could be used to save some of the disappearing land by putting it toward massive restoration projects. These are impacts from cumulative damage from industrial development, says Richie Blink, a former local official who now runs an ecotourism company near the mouth of the Mississippi River. We're staring these things in the face, he continued, and there's a lot that could be done. Cautious, but hopeful. Like many Plaquemines residents, Blink is hopeful that this is the beginning of accountability for oil and gas companies. Initially, he feared Chevron was untouchable. He was relieved by the verdict, though he points out that the jury award is probably pennies on the dollar compared to what the real damage is. Together, the dozens of remaining legacy lawsuits could secure large sums of money for communities across the Louisiana coast. Blink pointed to an earlier $100 million settlement with Freeport-McMoRan, a company responsible for only 4% of the wells drilled on Louisiana's coast. If that's an indicator of what's to come, there could be a lot of potential funding. But in light of decades of struggle against the industry and the current conservative administrations at the state and federal level, some still harbor doubts that the money the jury awarded will actually end up in the parish's coffers. Reverend Tyrone Edwards, chair of Plaquemines Parish Council, is both pleased about the end outcome and concerned that Chevron's expected appeal will reverse the result. The ruling is very good, and it would be good if we can get the money, said Edwards, who attended every day of the trial. It would be great because it's clear that the funds can only be used for coastal restoration, and we could use that kind of money. He pointed to damaged levees in need of reinforcement across the parish. But Edwards worries that if and when Chevron appeals, it will find a friendlier jury. That's part of why he is not counting on restoration funding just yet. For years, Chevron argued that the case should be heard in federal court, filing challenges and appeals that dragged the suit on. However, in a victory for advocates, the typically conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the lawsuit should remain in state court, and the U.S. Supreme Court later affirmed that decision. That history should perhaps bolster Edwards' hopes. Based on the history of the case, which bounced between state and federal courts for over a decade, I find Chevron's chance of appealing successfully highly unlikely, Matt Sedlar, a climate analyst with the Center of Economic and Policy Research, told Sierra. Not impossible, just unlikely. And with the success of this case, similar cases now have a path to success. Strange allies and a ticking clock. The plaintiffs also have odd but powerful allies. Louisiana's industry-friendly governor, Jeff Landry, and the state's current attorney general, Liz Murrell, have sided with the plaintiffs in the suit, even as it has drawn ire from powerful industry backers. This week, after the verdict, former U.S. Attorney General William Barr sent a letter to Murrell on behalf of industry groups urgently asking her to reconsider her position, arguing that land loss in Louisiana has been largely attributed to federal management of the Mississippi River. Fossil fuel enthusiasts have long blamed coastal land loss on the Army Corps of Engineers, which builds the levees and that prevent regular flooding. The lack of flooding stops the river from building land through alluvial deposits. Even Landry has echoed this line of thought, which makes it all the more surprising that he followed his Democratic predecessor in supporting the suits. Murrell rejected Barr's pleas. The facts at trial showed Chevron's predecessor, Texaco, illegally dumped 100 million gallons of contaminated water into the marsh and continued to do so after 1980, while also being paid by other companies to inject their wastewater into Chevron Texaco's saltwater disposal wells, Murrell responded on social media. So it knew the law but chose profits over environmental compliance, a somewhat startling critique from an administration that has long championed deregulation and fossil fuels. The case is not completely settled yet. On July 10th, parties will go back to the Point de la Hatch courtroom to discuss the size of the final award amount. Chevron argues interest should accrue only from the day of the verdict. Plaintiffs argue interest should be dated from the start of the court case 13 years ago. The difference would likely amount to hundreds of millions of dollars. And in Plaquemines Parish, every month counts, as Reverend Edwards makes clear. Hurricane season began June 1st. And anything that comes in, it causes problems to the land, he warned. Storms damage the fragile coastal marshlands, which in turn allow storm surge to advance further inland in a destructive feedback loop. Every time it does damage to the ecosystem. Blink, also, is keenly aware of the pressure of time. He says that the floodgates near him are closing about 100 days out of the year, whereas when I was a kid, they were closing only if a hurricane was coming the next day. Whatever the total amount, the funds will likely go into the state's Coastal Trust Fund, which is used to fund restoration projects that are part of the Coastal Master Plan. A bill passed in 2022 dictates that funds from coastal zone violations should go toward coastal protection. The state's Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority has said that it does expect the awarded money to be deposited into the fund. Every hour, a little bit more of this fragile coast washes away, but maybe, this time, hope really is in order. Our next scheduled article is fairly long, comes to us from the Nature Conservancy, and is titled Life at the Water's Edge. A frequently flooded neighborhood on the outskirts of Baltimore is fighting to envision a climate-resilient future. This was written by Dinah Fine Marin. We'll do our best to fit it in. On a muggy morning in June, Edith Eddie Brooks, 76, leans over to pick up an old chip bag teetering close to the water at Turner Station Park, a Chesapeake Bay access point about 20 minutes outside downtown Baltimore, Maryland. She crushes the litter in her hand. "I like things to be clean and green," she says. "I can't help myself." It's a Saturday, but the retired nurse has already been up for hours clearing brush, weeding, and picking up trash throughout the community. Brooks, a lifelong resident of this historically black community, sits in the shade for a few moments and looks out at a huge grassy hill on the far side of the water. The hill is more than 100 feet tall, but it's not a natural part of the landscape. "That's a landfill," she says with a sigh. She and other residents worry about the potential for leaks. Looming in the distance, the landfill, stocked with asbestos, solid waste, and industrial pollutants, is a decades-old reminder of the toxic legacy of steelmaking in the area. Turner Station grew in the shadow of Bethlehem Steel Corporation, a major U.S. manufacturer that provided material for the nearby Baltimore shipyards. In the mid-20th century, the neighborhood was a bustling community, home to many of the mill's workers. Today, years after the closure of the steel mill, Turner Station, like so many post-industrial communities in America, is faced not only with the remnants of industrial waste, but also with growing climate-related hazards. "They suffer from almost every environmental stressor you can imagine," says Isaac Hemetz, Baltimore Program Director at the Nature Conservancy. Located along the Patapsco River near the Chesapeake Bay, Turner Station has challenges, including continual flooding exacerbated by climate change and air quality concerns related to the nearby Baltimore port. Its waterways are polluted. Maryland authorities have placed fish consumption advisories for crab and multiple fish species around the area's waters due to industrial pollutants, but people continue to fish there and consume what they catch. At this point, the article breaks for a series of photographs. The first is three folks doing some landscaping, looks like, cutting back brushes, and it's captioned, "Inside Turner Station." As climate change brings more frequent floods to Turner Station, residents like community leader Olivia Lomax and her granddaughter, Tasha Barnes, are working alongside the Nature Conservancy to discover climate resilience in nature and in their neighborhoods. The second photograph features a canal with what appears to be some trees and apartment buildings alongside of it and is captioned, "Shoreline." The community of Turner Station sits near sea level between the Patapsco River and Bear Creek. And finally, the third picture is again of a river or canal and a swooping, soaring bridge over it, concrete bridge and some shoreline, and it's captioned, "Toxic Legacy." Turner Station, like so many post-industrial communities, sits alongside the industry that once made it a boomtown. Across a narrow creek, Sparrows Point, once home to a major steel factory, is always in sight. And the article continues. In 2024, the Francis Scott Key Bridge across the river collapsed after a cargo ship collided with it, thrusting the community into the national news. Six people died, and the collapse created further economic and environmental concerns as it cut off a major artery into Turner Station. Turner Station is the largest black community in Baltimore County, and its climate change-related threats mirror those that are increasingly and disproportionately facing communities of color around the country. Beginning to address such challenges in communities like Turner Station is a formidable task, but something Brooks and other residents are tackling one battle at a time. Nearly 25 years ago, members of the community formed an environmental and community improvement group called Turner Station Conservation Teams. They become a small community revitalization nonprofit made up mostly of retirees, including Brooks, who is a board member. They fight to celebrate the area's history, ensure safeguards against legacy toxic sites like that landfill, and secure government funding to support community projects. But they need help. In the past few years, the group has worked with nonprofits, including the Nature Conservancy and Neighbors Space of Baltimore County, and agencies like the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, as well as local and state governments. The Conservancy has worked to connect them to other groups and to potential grants. Together, they're beginning to envision a cleaner, safer future for Turner Station. It's the kind of envisioning that many communities are beginning to consider as they face a hard truth, that climate is changing the world around them, sometimes in ways that make staying in their neighborhoods challenging. And we finish with another photograph, two women, one seated, one standing, at a picnic table with a bay behind them, trimmed lawn and trees, and is captioned, "Community Leaders." For many years, a local group called Turner Station Conservation Teams has advocated for the neighborhood, which sits alongside a polluted waterway and frequently floods. Residents Edie Brooks and Gloria Nelson, left, lead the group in advocating for change. That concludes the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining us for the June 18th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.